This is Haystack Help Radio on KLZ 560. Haystack Help Radio is powered by HaystackHelp.com. Finding help can be like finding a needle in a haystack, but with HaystackHelp.com, finding the needle just got easier. Now, Haystack Help Radio with Scott Watley on KLZ 560.
Welcome to Haystack Help Radio. Thank you so much for being with us. We're going to be playing for you here these next few weeks some segments from a show that I have the privilege of doing in Dallas with a doctor, Dr. Lewis Coates. And he has a family medical practice there in the Dallas area. And he just brings some great information, and I wanted to share it with our Haystack audience here as well. So again, he is not a local doctor. He's out of the Garland, Texas area, but just great health information. So we're going to join that conversation now with Dr. Lewis Coates. Dr. Coates, how are you, sir?
I'm doing wonderful. Thanks for having me on.
You bet, man. It is always good to have you on. And this is a topic we have not hit on in almost a year of doing the show now. And we're going to talk about kind of our digestive system, gastrointestinal GI disorders, and different things like that. And boy, some of the research I was doing just a little bit this morning on this, there's a whole lot of parts in our body that make up our digestive system, isn't there?
That's correct. It's a very complicated system, and a lot of people have issues with the digestive system. It's a pretty common complaint. So.
All right. So, there are certain doctors that are gastrointestinal doctors that deal with all this. So let's just go through some of the common things that you see in your office.
The most common probably is going to be acid reflux. That's a pretty common disorder. And what that is people have trouble digesting food. They eat food and they have burning in their stomach. They feel bloated a lot. And then they get a chest discomfort up in their chest where it feels like acid's coming up. Sometimes they'll even physically throw up acid at night, and that's a pretty common disorder. Hmm. It's caused by the lower esophageal sphincter. Sphincter's like a little valve that sits at the bottom of the esophagus and at the top of the stomach, and it's supposed to keep that acid coming back up into your chest. And on a lot of people, that sphincter doesn't close correctly. Hmm. And certain foods, such as caffeine products, tomato products, peppermints, spicy foods, all these things cause our body to produce more acid, and some of them cause that sphincter to not close correctly. Caffeine's a big cause of that. So if you drink a lot of caffeine, sometimes your lower esophageal sphincter won't close correctly. And then you'll get this burning up in your chest, and particularly if you lay down at night. We tell people with acid reflux, prop their head way up, so gravity will help pull that acid back down. But a lot of them, when they lay down at night, they'll have acid, real bad acid symptoms. They'll wake up choking on acid, and it's a common cause of cough. One of the most common causes we see of cough in the clinic is acid reflux.
Wow.
And most.
Wow.
And a lot of patients won't believe it, so you'll have to you have to try to prove it to them. You have to say, look, let's try you on this medicine. We get them on a proton pump inhibitor or a histamine H2 blocker, and those medicines decrease the amount of acid in your stomach, and they do a lot better. But there's a lot of factors that contribute. You know, eating a large meal, laying down right after a large meal.
Right.
When patients are overweight, that tends to contribute more to acid reflux, snacking close to bedtime. And then, like I said, certain foods, citrus foods, tomatoes, chocolate, peppermints, onions, garlic, spicy foods, and foods that are high in fat. Those are probably the most common culprits, alcoholic beverages, mm-hmm. like I said, things with caffeine in it. And then smoking has a tendency to cause a lot of acid reflux. So, you know, we tell people, hey, if you smoke, you need to quit smoking, cut down on the alcohol, cut down on the spicy foods. Those are all things that will contribute to it. And then when women are pregnant, a lot of women may never have acid reflux except during their pregnancy. So it's very common when they're pregnant to have problems with acid reflux. And that's because the baby sometimes puts pressure on the stomach, pushing some of that acid up into the esophagus.
Okay.
But it's an extremely common problem, and I would say there's not a day go by we don't have somebody come in with acid reflux. And another problem that's very similar is something called a hiatal hernia. Mm-hmm. And a hiatal hernia is where the top part of the stomach gets pulled through the diaphragm, and acid gets stuck in that top part. So it's like a little balloon that sits in your chest, and it's very and that's a very troublesome problem. And a lot of times that has to be surgically repaired. We can treat it with HT blockers and PPIs, but a lot of times eventually we have to get surgery done to correct the hiatal hernia.
Right. Now, with acid reflux, you see a lot of different ads on different meds and stuff. So someone's having to take those meds all the time. Is there something else that sometimes you have to go to another step besides meds? Like, is there any surgery that helps acid reflux, or is it mainly just
There's quite a few different surgical procedures that can be done for acid reflux. So if someone is not responding to medications, or if their acid reflux is extremely severe, and one of the other things you got to be careful of with acid reflux is sometimes the lining of the esophagus. If there's too much acid in it all the time, that can cause that esophageal membrane to change from one type of cell to another, and that can actually turn into a cancer problem. So if somebody has cancer, so one of the things we do when someone has significant acid reflux for extended periods of time is a lot of times we'll send them to a GI doctor, and they'll do a biopsy, okay? And they'll go down and they'll do an endoscopy, and that's where they put a scope in there, and they look to make sure no one has ulcers, which is another problem very similar to this. And they'll look in there, and then they'll take a biopsy of the mucosa to make sure that it's not becoming a precancerous type problem.
Okay.
And we call that Barrett's esophagus when it changes from a healthy mucosa to a cancerous type mucosa.
Now, do you mostly see this in people over, 40 or 50 or 60? I mean, can it hit any age?
Technically, yes, it can be at any age, but it's more commonly in people over the age of 40. So, we usually see it in someone who's had acid reflux for a long period of time, okay? So I'll see a 50-year-old guy, and he says, I've had this problem for 30 years, and it's getting worse, and then we'll send him over, and he's never had an endoscopy done. Maybe he was just taking Tums at home, trying to treat it by himself. And there's a lot of things people can use at home now. So a lot of patients will use Pepcid over the counter, Tagamet over the counter. You have Nexium over the counter. You have Prilosec over the counter. And these were prescription drugs back when I first got into medicine that you could only get from a doctor. And now they've come out. So it used to be we saw this all the time because, every day you'd see patient after patient after patient with acid reflux. But those numbers have decreased some because a lot of patients do treat it on their own. They'll come in and tell you, I take Prilosec every day and it controls my acid reflux. And I said, well, then that's fine.
Right.
Taking a lot of Tums, though, can be dangerous. So we don't like people doing that.
Okay. Now, some things I was looking up this morning, they termed it GI disorder. Some things said GI diseases. So is there two different sections of that?
No, those are the same thing.
Okay.
That's just semantics on that.
All right. Now, another thing we've got here is fatty liver disease.
Yeah, fatty liver disease goes hand in hand with acid reflux. Like we said about acid reflux, alcohol is one of the big causes, and being overweight is one of the big causes. Well, when it comes to fatty liver disease, the number one cause is alcohol. And fatty liver disease is simply when fat is deposited in your liver, okay? So you have your liver, we take a sonogram of it, and they'll say, hey, your liver's enlarged, and there's a lot of fat deposits in there making it swell. And that's because you got fat that went into your liver. The most common cause of that is alcohol. Okay, so anytime we see somebody with fatty liver disease, we usually will question and make sure that, hey, are you drinking a lot of alcohol? Is there anything we don't know? So a lot of times people will come clean, oh, yeah, I drink, they'll say, I don't drink that much, and I drink a 12-pack every night,
Right.
And you're like, okay, that is a lot, So you always have to get the patient to define what they think is a lot, because what you think is a lot and what they think is a lot usually are two different things.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of times when we see fatty liver, that's the first thing we talk about is how much alcohol do you drink. If they don't drink alcohol or they rarely drink alcohol, then we have to start looking at other causes of fatty liver disease. And the most common cause of fatty liver disease is going to be gaining weight. Okay, so whenever someone gets, whenever someone starts gaining weight, you know, it puts fat in our arms and our legs and our stomach, but it's also putting fat in our organs too. And the big one is the liver. And so someone who has non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, and we usually abbreviate that NAFLD, you'll see that sometimes in the medical literature, or something called NASH, which is non-alcoholic steatohepatitis, and that usually develops after the non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. If it goes on long enough, it becomes a little more aggressive and there's inflammation in it, and that's what we call NASH. And then these can be serious disorders. So a lot of these people, we send them to a hepatologist, which is just a liver specialist, and they'll talk to them about getting this weight down, because unfortunately in people with NASH, their liver enzymes start rising pretty rapidly, and it can cause them to have liver failure. So it can cause significant problems. So in those people, getting their weight down becomes a big problem. And, you know, diabetes, insulin resistant, which we call metabolic syndrome, where someone gains weight and they become insulin resistant. That's a pre-diabetic stage metabolic syndrome. And then they just start to get real high triglycerides in their blood. These are things that we know from past studies cause fat to be deposited in the liver, and it causes these, sometimes this fat can become toxic to some of the liver cells. And that can scar the liver, cause damage to the liver, and cause significant problems. So for these people, getting the weight down and making sure that they don't drink. Mm-hmm. And sometimes for these people, we have to be careful what medicines we use, because medications are metabolized by the liver. And so if somebody has, you know, pretty significant non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, and that NASH, like I said, is developing, then we'll talk to the hepatologist about what medicines can we use. Sometimes he'll say, look, we have to take them off this medicine because their liver's not working good and it's metabolized by the liver, and try to get these liver enzymes down. And you'd be surprised, you know, how much losing weight does for these people. If they can drop, you know, 20% of their or 10% of their body weight,
right,
it makes a huge difference on the liver. And so a lot of times when we start to see this NASH developing, we really have to focus on diet and exercise.
Gotcha. You're listening to Better Health with Dr. Lewis Coates. Once again, his practice is located at 5915 Murphy Road there in Sachse. The number is 972-496-6937. So what symptoms would you say, you know, as far as what we're talking about today with the just stomach issues or whatever, that if you say, hey, if you're feeling this and you're feeling it, you know, this often and the pains are lasting this long, boy, you need to seek medical attention.
Yeah, I think when we're talking about acid reflux, if you're not able to control it and you're having symptoms multiple times a week, then we need to get into a doctor and get it under better control. Because a lot of these people will have, like I said, chronic cough. They could develop asthma from this. So it can cause significant trouble down the road, and it should be addressed. So, you know, if somebody has burning in their chest, then we need to look at it and make sure it is acid reflux, you know, because a lot of times acid reflux can present exactly like heart pain. So, you know, it's not uncommon for someone to go into the hospital, be put in the ICU for what turns out to be gastroesophageal reflux disease. We call it GERD, and it turns out to be that and not their heart. So that is a you know, something that should be addressed. If you're having tightness in your chest, then we should look at that and make sure that it is actually acid reflux and we're not missing heart disease or some other type of lung problem that's causing this disorder. You know, if it goes away overnight, you take some Prilosec and it's gone in the next few days, and I would say it's probably was acid reflux.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's persistent or recurrent, then we should definitely look at it.
All right. Now, this is a term I think most of us have heard, Crohn's disease, but if we haven't had it ourselves or known someone that have it, I'm not sure if we all know what that means. So what is Crohn's disease?
Yeah, there's two types of, these are called inflammatory bowel diseases, okay, and there's two of them that are the big ones, and they can be very life-changing disorders. And we see commercials for them all the time. The first one is Crohn's disease, and the second one is ulcerative colitis, and they both present very, very similar, okay? And a lot of these people get fever, chills, body aches, they're tired all the time. Those are symptoms that are common with Crohn's disease. Ulcerative colitis, we don't always see a lot of fever, fatigue. Both of them, we see a lot of rectal bleeding. So patients will come out and say, I'm getting blood in my stool, or I see blood in the toilet sometimes, or my stools are getting black and tar-like. When you see black tar-like stools, that means usually there is blood in the stool. On maroon-colored stools, if it's black and tar-like, it's usually way up in the colon because it's oxidized as it came through, and that's what made it black. If it's bright red blood, the bleeding's usually in the closer to the end, so it's in the rectum or the sigmoid colon, which is right there by the rectum. If it's in the we see the maroon stools, usually it's about halfway through. But both ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease can cause rectal bleeding. A lot of times, you know, the stomach tenderness. Okay, mm-hmm. Both of them usually have some type of cramps. They say my stomach hurts all the time. You know, I get cramps so bad I can't do anything. Those are common disorders with both of them. What sets the ones, the two things that really set the things apart is the abdominal masses. Crohn's disease, sometimes you can, they'll have a mass present, but it's usually never present in ulcerative colitis. And the distribution also. Crohn's disease has what we call skip lesions, meaning that this part of the bowel is infected, but then this part's normal, and then there's a piece down here that's infected, so it skips around in different parts of the colon, okay, and the large and small intestine. With ulcerative colitis, usually it's one continuous area, okay, and it's usually in the large intestine, but it's got one big long piece that's affected. So those are things that really set it apart. The good thing about ulcerative colitis, because it is one continuous section, a lot of times it can be treated surgically. They can go in, remove the infected area, and a lot of these people do perfectly fine after that.
Okay.
So if there's a disease portion, they go in, they simply cut out that disease portion, and they're cured. With Crohn's disease, you can't cut it out because it's little pieces all over the different areas of the bowel. So surgery is not usually a very good option unless there's just a part that has to be removed because it's so diseased. But for most of the time, Crohn's disease is not a surgical intervention. It's a medication. And now you're seeing all kinds of commercials on TV about Crohn's disease because they've come up with some new autoimmune treatments. Because what's happening in inflammatory bowel disease is your immune system is attacking your own colon, and that's what's causing the issues. So now we have a lot of these disease modifying medications that are very potent, and they can go in, decrease your immune response, and these people do significantly better, and it's life-changing for some of these people because ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease can be so debilitating that people can't even go out to eat, they can't go to a store, because they don't think that there's enough time that they can get to a bathroom or that they'll have cramps so bad. They're literally a lot, it can get so severe that they're almost trapped at home because they don't want to go anywhere.
Wow.
Because they're worried that what if I go to Walmart and someone's in the bathroom and I end up going in my pants or they start bleeding or, you know, there's just a lot of things that cause issues with these people. And so these new medications have been life-changing for people. And they're always very anemic because, like I said before, we see blood in the stool. When you're losing blood, it's hard to replace the blood when it's being lost at the same rate that it's being lost. So a lot of these people are tired, worn out. They're anemic. They don't have a lot of blood in their body, and they have to get transfusions sometimes. So these inflammatory bowel diseases are very, very severe. Now, something that presents and looks like inflammatory bowel disease, but is not, is called IBS, irritable bowel syndrome.
Okay.
And irritable bowel syndrome is symptoms very, very similar. Belly pain, cramping, gas, bloating, changes in stool. Sometimes they're constipated. Sometimes they have diarrhea. Sometimes they have some blood in their stool. And sometimes, you know, a lot of times they have significant hemorrhoids that go with IBS, and that causes the blood in there. So IBS is very, very similar to inflammatory bowel disease. And we have to, IBS is a diagnosis of exclusion. There's not one test that tells you, hey, I got IBS. There are some things that are typically pretty good indicators somebody has IBS. IBS is frequently aggravated by stress. So if somebody gets extremely stressed out and they start to have stomach cramps and problems, they say, every time I have a test or every time I have a deadline at work, I get cramps real bad and I get diarrhea real bad. Those are usually good signs that it's that it can be IBS. Inflammatory bowel disease usually is not as much related to, they don't see a link to stress as much as we do with IBS. Another key factor is with IBS, they go to the bathroom and then they feel better, okay? So someone with IBS will have tremendous pain, he's cramped over, feels like he's, you know, it can be so severe, women say it feels like they're giving birth almost sometimes. You have women come in and says,
wow,
I feel like I'm having another baby and I'm not pregnant. And they said, then I go to the bathroom and it all goes away. It's not prolonged like, you know, labor pains, but I tell them it's similar because what happens with IBS is the colon is cramping down. So it's contracting just like the uterus does when they do have a baby. So the internal symptoms sometimes do feel kind of similar, because it is a cramp, and it's this colon is contracting and it's pushing stuff through either too fast or too slow, and that's why we have intermittent constipation and diarrhea with IBS. There's a lot of gas, a lot of swelling, but typically they'll be so severe and then they run to the bathroom and they'll have tremendous cramps in the bathroom and then it's all gone and then they're fine for quite a while, okay? That's a pretty good indicator of IBS. If they say, you know, it's really, really bad, then I go to the bathroom and I'm okay for quite a few hours and then I might have another attack, okay?
Wow.
Those are usually signs of IBS versus, and they could be mixed, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Just because you have inflammatory bowel disease doesn't mean you can't have IBS with it, okay? So sometimes you have a mixed problem, but most of the time it's one or the other. So if we send somebody to GI and they get a colonoscopy and it's all normal and the CAT scan was normal, then a lot of times we'll say, look, you don't have Crohn's or ulcerative colitis, but you have IBS. And IBS can be just as debilitating, and it's a very common disorder. It impacts about 35 million Americans every year. So this is not something that, you know, is uncommon. This is something that is extremely common. And it does cause people to miss a lot of work, kids miss a lot of school. So, you know, it's a very, very common problem. It's a very, very severe problem. And it can get extremely severe to where people don't want to go to work or they don't want to go to school. And we have to figure out ways to try to work around with these people and control their symptoms.
Right. In the last few minutes here, but boy, I've had a few friends that have had this, and man, it was miserable. And like all these others are miserable too, but diverticulitis.
Yeah, diverticulitis is another common GI problem. And diverticulitis is where we have pockets in the colon, and they're like little balloons that stick out in the colon, and food can get in there and get stuck and get infected. And it can, you know, first you have diverticulosis, and those are the pockets, okay?
Okay.
Diverticulitis is when food goes in the pocket, and then that food gets infected, and then what happens then is your immune system starts attacking the area and you get a huge inflammation, and that can burst open. If that burst open, now you have parts of your food and stool leaking into your peritoneal space, and that's extremely dangerous. We call that peritonitis, and that type of infection can be potentially fatal. So, you know, people with diverticulitis, if you have severe pain, it's usually on the left side and the left lower quadrants where we most commonly see it.
Mm-hmm.
So if somebody has pain on the left lower quadrant of their abdomen, they should go to a doctor. And you should go in, get checked out, and usually that requires antibiotics right away because you don't want that infection to get too bad to where it causes it to rupture. And if it burst open, now you're talking about a surgical procedure that's very complicated because of the risk of infection. Once that thing burst open, now you have tremendous infection around all your organs, and that can be very, very dangerous.
Right. So in closing out today, are there ways for us to kind of keep our digestive system healthy? Is there anything we can do proactively?
Yeah, I think the most proactive thing you can do is keep your weight down and don't drink or smoke. I mean, I remember when I first got into medicine, this old man, he was a GI doctor, and he was about to retire, and I was talking to him about one of my patients, and he said, "You got to tell the guy to quit drinking and smoking." He goes, "Let me tell you, I've made tens of millions of dollars because of cigarettes and alcohol." He goes, "That's where all my business comes from." So, you know, wow. I think that we really have to start focusing on not smoking, not drinking a whole lot, and then keeping our weight down. You know, the lower our weight, the healthier we are. There's certain foods, like we talked about just before, you know, fatty foods, greasy foods, spicy foods, you know, and then those things tend to cause more trouble. But exercise, diet, and then keeping the smoking and drinking from, you know, not doing it at all is best, but that's usually not an option for most patients.
Right.
So, you know, keeping it to a minimum, you know, is something that can definitely change your GI habits for sure. And then when you have antibiotics, taking probiotics, because, you know, there are healthy bacteria that live in our gut and they help us digest food. If those bacteria get killed off by antibiotics, then we have an overgrowth of bad bacteria that do not help us digest food, and they're stealing basically the nutrients from the food from us, and that causes a lot of significant digestive problems and diarrhea. So, you know, whenever you take antibiotics, it's not a bad idea to take a probiotic after you're done or while you're taking it.
Absolutely. Well, the main thing, Dr. Coates, too, and just about every condition we talk about on this show, we just say, hey, if something's not feeling right, get in to see the doc, because I'm sure you've never had anybody go, wow, I just wish I hadn't have come so early. But you had, you probably had many conversations where I wish you would have come a little sooner.
Yeah, we always, unfortunately, that seems to be a recurrent conversation that as medical doctors we have. We feel that with patients all the time. When someone comes in, we think, man, if we could have just got this a week earlier or 2 weeks earlier,
mm-hmm.
you know, or sometimes it's months earlier. I mean,
sure.
You know, unfortunately, some people let things go for a year or 2 years or 3 years. And, you know, like I said, with the reflux problem, you know, Barrett's esophagus develops over time. So if you're having significant problems with reflux, you know, you should get in, see the doctor, and let him follow you, because at some point they may want to do an endoscopy on you.
Gotcha. Well, Dr. Coates, as always, great information, and we appreciate your time today, sir.
Thank you for having me, and see you next week.
All right. That was Dr. Lewis Coates. And once again, if you're just joining us, Dr. Coates' practice is in Garland, Texas. We do a show each week there in the Dallas area called Better Health, and he just shares some great information, so I wanted to share it with you, our Haystack audience. You're listening to KLZ 560. We got to take a short break, and we'll be back with more right after this.
This is Chris Kane with 303 Roofer. If you have an insurance claim on your roof and want to keep some of that money in your pocket, give us a call and we'll give you a cash bid to replace your roof. You pay insurance every month and now insurance has paid you. It's your money and we understand that. So give us a call at 303-390-1382 or visit our website, 303roofer.com.
Take AIM. Affordable Interest Mortgage has been offering the Asset Manager All-in-One Loan for over 11 years. We are experienced in helping homeowners pay thousands less in interest on their mortgage, own their home faster, all without spending one dime more. 720-895-0500. Take AIM. Affordable Interest Mortgage, where we have hundreds of clients that have been using this loan to build their equity faster, access emergency funds when necessary, and pay off their home in 8 to 13 years versus 25 to 30. People initially believe this loan is too good to be true, but it is true. Call 720-895-0500 now to see if you qualify. Loans from $100,000 to $2.5 million, same rate. Ask our previous clients. They will tell you it works. Call 720-895-0500 and work with the experts. This loan has been around since 1965. Affordable Interest Mortgage, where it's all about you. 720-895-0500. Regulated by DOR, NMLS 298191, Equal Credit Lender.
Avoid the pitfalls with Kevin Flesh. Picture this. You're in court before a judge and jury trying to get the at-fault party's insurance company to cover your hospital bills, and the defense attorney pulls out your medical records. Comparing what you said to the police at the scene of your injury to what your doctor transcribed, you've contradicted yourself. You start to get nervous. You don't want to look like an idiot, but you simply don't recall what you said to the police. That was a long time ago. KLZ's personal injury attorney, Kevin Flesh of Flesh and Beck Law, prepares you for these kinds of questions so you never need to worry about what to say. Of course, the opposition will always try to call your credibility into question. But with Kevin Flesh, you always know exactly how to respond. Schedule a free consultation now at 303-806-8886. Kevin Flesh of Flesh and Beck Law. Trial tested. Trial ready.
Rush to Reason with John Rush. Weekdays from 3 to 7 on KLZ 560.
Welcome to Protect Your Legacy. My name is Scott Whatley. We are glad you are with us. We are also very glad to have attorney Blake Harris with us from Mile High Estate Planning. And check out that website, milehighestateplanning.com. Blake, good to have you again on your show. How are you?
good to be back on the show. How are you doing, Scott?
I'm doing well. And I tell you, all the conversations that we have really helped me as I talk to friends and relatives and just people that listen to the show, and they say, man, I never knew that. So I am thankful we get to have you on each week to just talk about this whole matter of estate planning. And you know, there's a saying out there that says very few things go well without proper planning. So let's kind of discuss maybe what that difference is for those that plan and those that don't.
Sure. So I'm going to run the listeners through a hypothetical, I guess two hypotheticals. We've got individual A who does not do any estate planning whatsoever. And we've got individual B who does a does all the estate planning that they can do to help protect their legacy.
Okay.
So both individuals, similar profile, we'll say married, they have a business, they have a rental property, and both of them, they're worth, let's say, $1 million. So we're going to start with I'm not going to call them client because they didn't do any estate planning, but person A, family A, they've got $1 million. They're going through their life. They're focusing on running their business. They're not looking at the big picture. And then one day, they get hit with a lawsuit. They're notified that they are being sued for $1 million. It may be something that went wrong in their business. It could be because one of their children is driving a car that they own, or it could be because of something to do with their real estate rental property. Whatever the reason is, they are faced with a pretty serious lawsuit. It's very scary for them. They have to go out, hire an attorney to fight the case. They're able to get the defendant down to about $500,000. And as opposed to risking losing everything they have, they go ahead and settle the case for about $500,000. They've got no asset protection in place, and they don't want to risk losing everything. They acknowledge they've done something wrong. So they go ahead and settle the case for about $1 million. So all of a sudden, this first individual, their net worth drops to about $500,000.
Okay.
Now, they get older, and as they get older, they forget to or fail to sign a power of attorney documents. They've retired. They're no longer concerned about any more lawsuits. They had to sell off their rental home anyways, so that's not going to be sell off the rental home to pay for the lawsuit judgment. So now they're down to about $500,000 in assets, but they lose capacity. They don't have a financial power of attorney or medical power of attorney. And their three children, they don't get along perfectly. There's a conflict that arises, and the family has to go through a very costly guardianship and conservatorship proceeding. There's probate that takes place after someone passed away, but there's also probate that occurs when an individual loses capacity. And this comes in the form of a guardianship or a conservatorship proceeding. And because there's a dispute within the family and the parents haven't done any planning of their own, this fee ends up costing $100,000, which is not very unusual
for, I mean, it's on the higher end, but it's not very unusual for probate during lifetime to run that high. Lifetime probate tends to be maybe $5,000 to $10,000 for an uncontested estate, or maybe $10,000 to $30,000, $40,000 for a contested estate. But for a probate that occurs while you're alive, guardianship and conservatorships, these proceedings are much more expensive. They require reporting to the court every single year. There's ongoing issues that come up. It's kind of like getting a divorce with children, where there's ongoing custody issues. There's ongoing issues fighting with the parents. So the family blows through another $100,000 dealing with probate while the parents are still alive. This brings their estate from about $500,000 down to around $400,000. Okay. What happens next, now that mom and dad are incapacitated? Well, they need to move into a nursing home. So the average cost of a nursing home runs about $5,000 to $10,000 per month. There's two individuals. This could cost $100,000 or more in nursing home costs. Definitely not unusual for a couple to spend more than $100,000 in nursing home care. However, for the sake of our example, for the sake of our hypothetical, I'm just going to bring it down to a nice $95,000. So let's say that they get off relatively inexpensively on nursing home care, and they only have to spend $95,000. This leaves $305,000 that the couple still has at the time they pass away. Well, again, they didn't do any estate planning, and so once again, that property needs to go through probate. This is lifetime probate. The kids have already spent all that they can fighting while the parents were alive. They don't even have any money to fight now that the parents have passed away. And the probate goes down relatively smooth. This leaves about $300,000 left to distribute between the three children. Now, the three children, each of them have certain issues that they are facing. Issue number one, the oldest of the three child has actually a disability, and they receive government-based benefits. The middle child is doing okay in terms of health, but their marriage is on the line, and there may be a divorce coming down the road. And the third child, unfortunately, and this is common in lots of families, has some addiction problems, some drug and alcohol issues. So while the parents had $300,000 at the time they passed away, how much did that $300 actually end up in the pocket of the children?
Right.
Well, the very first child, the oldest of the three that's on disability, actually has to spend all of that on their health care until they only have about $2,000 that remains. So that means that $100,000 that was intended for that child gets burned through on health care, and only $98,000 of it gets spent. Only $2,000 remains in the hands of that first beneficiary. The second beneficiary is in good health, no addiction issues, but the spouse is a dud. The second child gets a divorce. The money was left outright to that second child, and the divorcing spouse runs away with half of that. So instead of leaving $50,000 to the middle child, that child only gets $50,000. So instead of leaving $100,000 to that child only gets to enjoy the benefits of $50,000. And then the worst of it all was the money that ends up in the hands of the third child who has addiction issues. That child ends up blowing through all of it quickly, and we're not even going to speculate the harm that they do to themselves. In certain circumstances, money can hurt an individual. For most of it, it puts us in a better position. It improves our quality of life. For certain people, money is actually more harmful. So this family that had $1 million at one point in their lifetime due to lawsuits, nursing home cost care, and basically just poor planning, was only able to leave $52,000 to their children.
Well, and, you know, you said something interesting about halfway through there. You said, you know, the conflict that happens, and there's conflict that happens certainly, you know, maybe when a plan has been done, but I can only imagine the conflict. And most people don't think there's going to be a conflict, do they, Blake, with their own family?
And the truth is, you never know which plans are going to be. There's going to be a conflict. There have been certain plans which I was very confident there was going to be a conflict, where it looked like there was going to be a conflict even up until shortly after the death. And the probate went very smoothly. There have been other plans where the family got along great. Parents and children or parents and stepchildren who loved each other dearly, that relationship quickly falls apart. I've even seen a mother sue her own son due to some probate-related issues. You never know which is going to be the problem planned. You can't do anything to absolutely prevent it, but there's a lot you can do to minimize the risk associated with your estate being contested, which is what family number two did, plan B, family B. And let's talk about how they planned and how they compare and how things shook out for them by putting together
okay.
an estate plan. So once again, similar story, family B, they've got $1 million. They own their own business. They've got a rental property, three children as well. Just like the first family, they also find out you're being sued for $1 million. Well, the first thing that this family thinks is, we are so glad we contacted Blake Harris and put together an asset protection trust a while ago, because they had much more peace of mind over their assets. They knew that they were still going to have to defend the lawsuit. They knew that they'd probably end up needing to pay some type of settlement. But because they did planning in advance of the lawsuit, because they had kept control of the property throughout this entire process, they were able to, instead of settling for $500,000 like the first family, they were able to settle for just $100,000. So the lawsuit passes. There was an issue that arose. Maybe it was due to something with the real estate ownership or something running a business, or again, a very common one, children driving the parents' cars. They did get sued. They were not nearly as stressed over the lawsuit, and they made away with keeping $900,000 as opposed to only $500,000 like we saw in the first example. Next, as the family got older, they lost capacity, but the parents had put together all their incapacity documents. Mom and dad signed a financial power of attorney, a medical power of attorney, a HIPAA authorization, as well as a living will, or as it's called in Colorado, a declaration as to medical or surgical treatment. With these documents, the family was able to avoid the need for a guardianship and conservatorship proceeding. There was a clear outline of what the parents' wishes and goals were. There's no room for the children to fight or argue over it. And when they become incapacitated, they didn't have to spend any money on court fees or a court battle, saving them, compared to the previous family, $100,000.
That'll work.
That will work.
Yes, sir.
That's the best deal in the world of estate planning. Clients called me because they want the trust, or sometimes because they want the will. My opinion, the incapacity documents are possibly the most important, and incapacity documents are important whether you've got a grandparent who's 90 and living in a nursing home, or you have a child that just turned 18 and is going off to school here soon. Making sure that the people you want to control your financial and medical decisions can do so without getting the court involved. So moving along and getting older now, the parents have lost capacity. It's time for them to move into a long-term care facility. Again, this family did a good job of planning. So instead of needing to move into, instead of needing to pay out of pocket each month for the long-term care, they had their assets secured inside of a Medicaid Asset Protection Trust, a vehicle for reducing long-term care and nursing home costs. The government Medicaid, which they've been paying into their entire life, paid for their long-term care, and they ended up coming out of pocket a total of $0 for the long-term care expense. That right there is a real gem in the estate planning world, the ability to eliminate long-term care costs. If you have the money and are appropriate to buy long-term care insurance, you may want to buy it. I don't sell any insurance of any type, but I do think that is a good gift. If you don't have long-term care insurance, then putting together a Medicaid Asset Protection Trust could be an excellent tool for your family. Mom and dad eventually pass away. The assets are all held inside of a trust. There's no need to open a probate after they pass away. They still have the same three profiles, or the children have the same profile as the parents, as the children, the first example. The first individual, is on Medicaid. The second one has a marriage that's on the rocks. And the third one has some substance abuse issues. For the first child, instead of dumping all that money on them as soon as the parents pass away, the money is going to be held inside of a special needs trust. And this is what a special needs trust says. These are rather complex documents, but I can explain it in terms that are very simple. Anything the government, the trust is this. Anything the government is paying for, the trust isn't going to pay for. So instead of that $300,000 needing to be spent down, the trust is able to give to the child in ways that the government's not providing for them. So that child is able to maintain their standard of living and continue to receive their inheritance. And then when that child passes away, Medicaid, the state, is not going to come back and recover those funds. Those funds are then passed down to that child's children or to the other descendants of our clients. So child one, $300,000 is left for child one. There's $300,000 that's there for child one benefits. Child number two, and this is something that my clients who are been through a divorce are very excited to give this feature to the children. Child two gets their trust. We let them manage their trust as well because they're financially responsible. Their health is not going to cause any issue with government benefits. But child two, we don't have that money distributed outright to them. We just have that money held in trust. Mm-hmm. So they can manage the trust. They can choose who the trustee is. They can ultimately get a distribution anytime they want to, but the money isn't forced onto them. That way, when child two's spouse files for divorce or child two themselves files for divorce, that asset that they received, their inheritance, is not a marital asset. It's not available to be taken by a divorced spouse. Child two, instead of splitting their inheritance with their soon-to-be ex, gets to keep all $300,000 for themselves. And then child three, we set up a similar trust as well so that the money is held in trust. It's not given directly into the pocket of somebody who could blow it inappropriately. The money is managed by an independent trustee. We don't let a child who has substance abuse manage their own trust. And then that child, anytime that they're clean, anytime that they're pursuing good activities and not spending the money on drugs or alcohol, can benefit from that trust. So what's the total of that? $300,000 plus $300,000 plus $300,000. That comes out to about $900,000 that this family was able to pass down to their children.
Right.
This gives, if we compare the two, the first family was able to pass $52,000. The second family was able to pass $848,000. The second family was able to first family was $52,000. Second family was $900,000. This is a difference of $848,000. I get asked often, how much does an estate plan cost? Well, the real question is, or what you should really be concerned about is, how much does it cost to not have an estate plan?
Right.
Because it's not going to, because having an estate plan is not going to cost you $840,000.
Absolutely. And you know, most people are always looking around, hey, what's a great investment I can make? Here's one, right?
a lot of people right now are paying more and more attention to their investments. It's almost as if 2021 was as if 2020 was a year that people paid attention to their home. A lot of people purchased a home. A lot of people got a new interior designer. A lot of people took care of their lawn and got the home gym. And then I've seen this trend in 2021 where people now are paying attention to their investments. And I tell my friends, well, if you're concerned about your investments, let's talk about asset protection. It's a tool that, honestly, I hope you never use. Mm-hmm. But if you do use it, it very well could be the best investment that you ever make. Another investment, and I know that I've mentioned it on the show, and I'm going to be mentioning it on the show more and more in the coming months, because you're going to hear more and more about it, is cryptocurrency. It is becoming more and more mainstream. Everybody's hearing about it more and more. Soon enough, I suspect the U.S. government is going to transfer us over to a cryptocurrency. I am not, for anyone listening, I'm not making any recommendations that people go out and buy any cryptocurrency. I'm not recommending against it either. But I do recommend very strongly that you educate yourself on it. For starters, you can go to my website, milehighstatepaying.com. We have a few articles on cryptocurrency, some videos as well, where we talk about cryptocurrency, blockchain technology, Bitcoin. This is the way of the future, and those who pay attention to it, those who understand it, will be well prepared for the future. Those who don't, and I hear this often from clients, because I ask every client, do you have any cryptocurrency? Most of them are saying no. Lots of them are saying yes, but the majority are still saying no. When I ask why not, their answer over and over is because I don't understand it. To which I say, get to understand it, learn about it, pay attention to it. It's very much the way of the future.
Yes, absolutely. Once again, if you're just joining us, Attorney Blake Harris is with us. His is Mile High Estate Planning, as Blake just mentioned. Check out his website. Also, real quick, Blake, let's mention your book there, The Ultimate Guide to Estate Planning and Asset Protection.
Yes, absolutely. You can go online to milehighestateplanning.com, or if you want to just send me an email, blake@milehighestateplanning.com. Happy to share with you a free copy of the book that I published last year. Paints a very full picture of everything you need to know about estate planning, outlines all of your options when it comes to putting together an estate plan, from whether you need just a simple will-based plan or you need some very complex type of planning as well. Also, something I want to mention is now that it's the year 2021 and we have a new administration, it's looking like there's going to be some changes to the estate tax. Previously, the estate tax was high enough that very few individuals needed to do any planning. Under the proposed administration, the estate tax is likely going, under the new administration's proposal, the estate tax is likely going to come down significantly, meaning if you have just even a few million dollars in assets, you'd be wise to speak with an attorney. Going back to the comment on cryptocurrency, one more thing that I wanted to mention was, there's a very, my number one advice with cryptocurrency, blockchain technology, educate yourself. The number one myth surrounding cryptocurrency and blockchain technology is that it is anonymous. There is some component of anonymity to it. However, if you are subpoenaed, you are required to report to the court what your assets holdings are, and failure to report cryptocurrency can land you in jail. So what you want to do is be able to report that you have the cryptocurrency, but you want to be able to say that you hold it inside of a protected trust, which is not going to, number one, prevent you from receiving Medicaid, and number two, it's not going to be able to be lost in a lawsuit. A court can subpoena an online wallet or an online exchange, and if they do so and you haven't reported your cryptocurrency, you could face criminal sanctions. So what I say is educate yourself. If you do decide it is an appropriate investment, then give my office a call and let's talk about how you can protect that asset.
Absolutely. And, you know, Blake, you mentioned trust and you explained it very quickly and very briefly, but how many people do you sit down with that, had the wrong idea about even what a trust was about or just didn't fully understand it? Maybe that's a better way to ask you the question. Just didn't really understand what really a trust was all about and how many different types there are.
So one question that I ask some clients when they come into my office is, have you done any education? Have you done any research on estate planning? And when their client responds, not really, or just honestly with a no, my next comment is, good, I don't have to unteach you anything, because there's a lot of bad information out there, a lot of incorrect information that is being circulated when it comes to estate planning. So the first thing to understand is the basic difference between a will and a trust. A will allows you to do two things. Number one, it allows you to name a guardian for any minor children. So if you just had your first child or have one on the way, give my office a call. Let's make sure that we can nominate a guardian for your child. I'm sure that you have a family member that you'd be comfortable with raising your children if you were not able to. And I suspect, like most families, there may be another family member who you're not real excited about raising your minor children. So we want to make sure your wishes are outlined in your last will and testament. Last will can also transfer property to the individuals you've selected. However, a will is a ticket to the probate court. A trust, on the other hand, can do everything that a will can do. It can nominate a guardian. It can select who receives a property. But a trust can do a lot more for individuals, such as, number one, avoid probate. Mm-hmm. Other things that trust can do is help you qualify for benefits to pay for your long-term care, protect your property from lawsuits, reduce your estate taxes. Every individual can have just one will. You get one will. If you make a new will, your old one goes in the trash. But you can have multiple trusts. And in different circumstances, clients will set up multiple trusts for various different reasons. So the basic basic estate plan includes, number one, a will. Number two, at least one trust, a revocable living trust, and in some cases more than that. And then number three, a complete set of incapacity or power of attorney documents. This includes a financial, medical power of attorney, a HIPAA authorization, and a living will.
And you know one thing, Blake, I want to talk about here before we in today's segment is you offer free lifetime reviews, and I think that's, you know, crucial for your clients as well.
Yes. I believe that we offer a very good value for our clients. It starts with a free initial consultation. We can do it by phone call. We can do it by Zoom call. Or if you'd like, more than happy to have you into our office. We've got beautiful office space in downtown Denver with Union Station, with free parking next door. We're right next to Union Station. But most of our clients are choosing to meet by phone or Zoom call. At the end of that initial meeting, we'll quote you a price for your plan. You'll know exactly what you're going to pay. You're not going to be surprised by anything that comes up down the road. After the plan is created and everything has been signed, your client gets another 30 days to review, reconsider their plan, make any additional changes, no charge. If there's more changes needed more than 30 days afterwards, we charge a nominal fee for those updates and amendments. However, we give free lifetime reviews for our clients, which means if you create an estate plan with us and you have a few questions for us 6 months down the road or 10 years down the road, you pick up the phone, you give us a call. There's never any charge for clients who want to discuss their estate plan. Our goal is to keep your estate plan in line with your goals. And the more the clients are communicating with us, the more likely we're able to make that happen.
The number is 833-ASK-BLAKE, and again, that's 833-ASK-BLAKE. It's milehighestateplanning.com, and as Blake mentioned, you can reach him there by email, blake@milehighestateplanning.com. And Blake, it's also a free consultation, initial consultation. Hey, if somebody hears you today and, boy, they say, boy, I just got a couple of questions, then make an appointment with you, you welcome that as well, sir.
Yes, absolutely. It is always a free initial consultation. I do have one last thing to tell the listeners today. If you're considering starting the estate planning process, do me a favor, go online and do this. Google Mile High Estate Planning and read the reviews. We can talk about how great we are or how we do nothing but this type of work, but I think our clients' communication, I think our clients' word says it the most. We've got over 60 Google reviews. Every single one as of now is a 5 out of 5 stars. Go online, read some of the countless number of glowing reviews from current and former clients.
All right. And Blake, I have done that, and boy, it is very insightful to see how the customers explain their work with you. And boy, all of them very happy and all 5-star reviews. So we appreciate your time today, and we look forward to our next visit, sir.
Scott, it's always a pleasure. Look forward to getting some more good information to your listeners in the future, and hope some of them will give us a call to help with their planning.
All right, sir. Again, you've been listening to Protect Your Legacy with Attorney Blake Harris of Mile High Estate Planning. Once again, the number is 833-ASK-BLAKE. We've got to take a short break. We'll be back with more right after this.
Views and opinions expressed on KLZ 560 are those of the speaker and do not necessarily reflect those of Crawford Broadcasting, the station, management, employees, associates, or advertisers. KLZ 560 is a Crawford Broadcasting God and Country station.